Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our conversation about trauma. My name is Natalie Ramirez, and I am a team member of Catholic Charities. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Carl Fornoff, who is our regional director for Villa Maria Community Resources. Carl, welcome, and thank you for being with us today. Today, we are going to be talking a little bit about trauma and the impact it has on communities. And Carl, I was hoping you could tell our audience a little bit more about yourself and what you do for Catholic Charities.
Sure. So I'm a licensed clinical professional counselor. And like you said, I'm the regional director of our community programs, really. So I oversee five of our behavioral health clinics. That means counseling clinics. We provide counseling to all age groups and substance use treatment as well. And I also have a background in providing treatment to families, training clinicians on how to work with families who are having difficulty with behavioral health issues, and even doing some training with parents and families directly to them. And I also have a private practice where I work with families, and I have a big family.
Wonderful. I'm honored to have the opportunity to talk to you about this topic. And I know that when we tend to think about trauma as a personal experience, and which it is, and at the same time, when a high number of individuals or families in a community experience trauma, that means that there's a ripple effect on our community. So that's what we're going to be talking about with you today. For those who might not know or who might not have heard any of our other conversations surrounding the topic of trauma this week, could you just take a moment to briefly define what trauma is for us?
Yes. So trauma is the best definition to me is that it's a person's response to a deeply distressing event that overwhelms that person's coping skills. So the two key features in that definition are trauma is a person's response. It is individual to a person. You can't just go around naming events that are traumatic. I mean, you can, but when you come right down to it, you can have people that don't have the same response to the same event. It is a person's response. And our response is really from our nervous system. I'm going to talk about that later. It's pretty automatic how we respond to distressing events. The other big component of that definition is that it overwhelms our ability to cope. And so you would see traumatic responses that end in a day. You know, you talk to the person 3 days later, they're sleeping okay, they're back to their routine, and they're not experiencing trauma anymore. They were exposed to a traumatic event, but their nervous system adjusted. So that's the other part, is that trauma can overwhelm a person's ability to cope. And so you'll see, I've been into neighborhood responses to trauma. Actually, walked into neighborhoods where someone was stabbed, and into a defined community, even smaller than a neighborhood. And you would be able to see, actually, the neighbors would even point out to their fellow neighbor about who is really being affected here since yesterday when that happened. You know, they're all upset, but some of them are having a traumatic response that people should keep their eye on and monitor and possibly intervene on if it's there 3 days later.
So we've touched upon the fact that trauma is a very personal experience. And I think you've already touched a little bit about the fact that it does have a ripple effect. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I talked about its effect on the nervous system, and really the nervous system's designed to protect us. So our response to a traumatic event might be to become extremely vigilant. We might, in a severe example, and I guess the examples where we all learn from trauma, I think, is back in the 70s when people came back from Vietnam. And, it looked like they were showing bizarre behavior. In fact, they were having traumatic responses that they carried back with them that, you know, in a lot of cases were misdiagnosed or misidentified. And so we either respond to traumatic events with hypervigilance. You'll see the person lose sleep, have interrupted sleep, be extremely irritable, on edge, on alert in case that threat occurs again. Or we could go into a shutdown, just the opposite of that. It's called a hypo. Hypo means too little stress or arousal, hypo arousal. And in that case, we'll shut down. The body feels numb. It's like a shutdown. It's like a turtle going into its shell. And in that case, you will see someone who might appear frozen, or you could misperceive it to think that they're disinterested. And since we're social beings, right, we're interacting with other people, so these misperceptions are going to happen if we don't know what trauma is. We don't know that person, or even the person having trauma, doesn't know what's going on. It's easy to misperceive those two states. The hypervigilance state can look like a person's just got a chip on their shoulder, they're conflictual, they're non-compliant. And then the other person, that it looks really passive, can look like they're lazy, they don't care, that sort of thing. And so it will affect relationships, all kinds of relationships. And, you know, if you just think of, a great example is just that 10-year-old kid who, let's say, is exposed to kind of a drug culture in the housing that they live in the apartment building they live in. They hear loud noises late at night, unpredictably, doors slamming, people screaming or laughing. They see some conflict. They see a neighbor try to tell those people to quiet down, and the neighbor gets threatened. 10-year-old kid doesn't have any power over this or any say, doesn't have any great strategies to deal with something so complex. And maybe even hears, 2 weeks ago, heard gunshots. And the child does things. He's a social being. So he or she goes to school and has one of those reactions, has the hyper aroused reaction to trauma that eventually overwhelms that 10-year-old's coping skills. And they go to school and they're extremely on edge. They haven't slept really good for 6, 7, 8 nights. Can't concentrate in school. Looks like they don't want to concentrate or pay attention or listen. Has trouble with other kids. Anybody who's bothering him, anyone who disrespects that child, feels like a threat, nervous system wise. So, you know, we have all kinds of rippling effects. That's just a small example.
So let's take that example and expand on it a little bit if we can. I know that your specialty is in family approaches to mental and behavioral health and well-being. So kind of expanding on that, what kinds of things do you see in families when someone, for instance, a child, has survived a trauma? What are the effects on the family? You know, how does the family cope with that? How do we, you know, come in and help everyone understand and deal with that and move forward from something like that?
Yeah, in the best case scenario, if it gets identified and people recognize what's happening, it can be, you know, it can really be a healthy situation where the caretaker, the protector, right? This is all about safety and hope, safety and spirit, hope. If there's a really unconscious experience that I have that I'm not safe because I've been exposed to trauma and I'm a kid, and my parent tries to help me first of all, recognize what's going on, understand some of my kind of misbehaviors or unusual behaviors, and then support me getting into my routine, keeps an eye on me that I'm back into my routine. Routine is normalcy and can represent safety. And so that's good. And that, you know, I get some, let's just say if I'm eight years old and it's before bedtime and I'm in a very unusual way, just not going to bed, you know, that people put some extra time, that parents put some extra time into figuring that out. How can we figure out? Because, you know, it might take 5 or 6 days, but if you can get through it as a family and you can move forward, that could be really encouraging to a child's nervous system, that they can bounce back from something like that. But boy, there were a lot of perfect things in that example, that means that the parent wasn't affected by the trauma and was free to be that attentive. I didn't throw in other people, but you know, what you would like is you would like to be able to inform the child's teacher and to support the child the same way I just explained that the parent did. And then you could throw in other places, people that we all have had support from, you know, a coach or a, you know, somebody that is in our family that is significant to us, that puts in a little more time. Those sorts of things are just so important. And the good thing is we're starting to have a common language so that we can describe trauma and it's being recognized. And so more and more people are comfortable with calling it something that's not an excuse.
So if it wasn't a perfect world and the trauma did affect a parent or parents, yeah, or let's just say siblings and extended, yeah, family, aunts, uncles, grandparents, you know, how is the process then affected when it's sort of spills out to multiple people?
Yes. And I'm so glad you asked. I mean, even when we talk about parents, right, and parents will be affected. In my example, it's funny, in my earlier example about the 10-year-old exposed to the drug culture, probably the parent or parents in that family are too. They may have found a way not to act out their nervous system problems, but I doubt that they're not suffering. And so my answer to your question is that when the leaders of the family, whoever that is, grandparents, are affected by trauma, they're very likely to not be nearly as attentive to supporting, protecting, educating, leading the children in the family as they normally are. And so that's going to have rippling effects to the kids. That children are really good at picking up signals, especially unsafety. And the worst part about this is that if you think of a person's or a family's narrative, we all grew up in families, and hopefully, you know, we had, if you think of a narrative, that's kind of like what you say to yourself when you're walking around the world, going about your day. And if you're generally saying, we'll get through this, or, you know, we got this, or we're good. We're a good family, versus feeling like there's something wrong with us. At the core, there's something wrong with us. We're broken. That is a really, really serious problem if you're walking around thinking like that. And that's what trauma can do, because it has rippling effects on safety. The feelings of safety aren't there. It's just the opposite, that I gotta protect myself. I gotta be on edge, or I need to somehow numb myself and camouflage myself so that nothing's going to happen. And then we can have, again, back to the misperceptions, then we can have, because we have overreactivity in trauma, we can, if I really want to show the unhealthy version, you'll see increased marital discord or domestic violence or abuse, child abuse, overreactivity to misbehavior in the family, that sort of thing. So, yeah, that's not a very pretty picture there. But I guess I want to emphasize that if you think of safety, that's the feeling that every, you know, that I don't have to think of my general safety and put all that energy into it. I can, you know, I can play. I can, you know, have joy. Or if I'm a parent, you know, I can kick back at the end of a long day and just have my guard down. You know, everybody needs to do that. And it's harder to do when you're exposed or overexposed to traumatic things. That's the big part. The other part is the spirit. I hope people get that part too. If that narrative goes to, there's something wrong with me, or there's something wrong with us, and you're walking around that way, that's just really, really, that is suffering. You know, that really is the true word. The true, I think, poverty of the spirit, when you resign yourself that something's really wrong at my core.
Is it safe to say that at the core, community challenges from trauma start within individuals and families?
Yes, absolutely. I think of families as building blocks for the community. I know you can say businesses are, churches are, you know, they're building blocks for a community. But families are really big, important parts of the community.
And so how does that trauma spill out into the community? Can we expand a little bit on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we talked about if we have several or a lot of families experiencing trauma, and especially if they're not identifying it and not getting any outside support to deal with it, we really have two big problems. We have people that are in states that aren't conducive to getting along with other people, the hypervigilant state or the hypovigilant or hypoaroused state. And then we also have that misunderstanding piece where people assume that other people are mean, or if it's the hypoarousal, don't care. Lazy, that sort of thing. Those misperceptions coupled with the behavior issues that people can have when they're affected by trauma, that's not a good mix. And so the more of that you have, you absolutely would see more substance use to cope with the feelings that people are experiencing. You would see more drug activity in a community. You would see people care about their community less. So wouldn't be surprising to see streets that aren't clean, that sort of thing. And I guess back to the spirit part, another thing is we take this for granted in communities that work, is it's hard, the more people affected by trauma, and especially if they don't move through it. Again, if they don't move through it and there's multiple traumas, and we even have, you know, we have, we're not going to talk about that today, but we have, you know, trauma through generations. If that happens, it's hard to organize. Things like, I've seen communities, because I've worked in communities, and you'll see a community group that raises some money or gets political leadership to put some lights up in the local park so that there can be a young adult softball games at night or something like that. Well, you just don't see that if you have communities overwhelmed by poverty. That takes organization. It takes determination to see those kinds of projects through. Looks like a little thing, but think about you know, I was thinking about when I was small, my grandmother lived in the projects in East Baltimore, and we would go visit her. And during a Saturday, it wasn't unusual if we went out and we would play hopscotch or something like that, and we would hear the local marching band, because they had one, practicing on a Saturday. Well, if you grow up listening to the marching band instead of conflicts and things like that, or you're taking a walk and you see the Little League team playing across the street, it's a very different thing than hearing conflict or seeing gradually as you're growing up, seeing drug activity that you think will never go away. There's no sense that that's even wrong. It's just part of what goes on. And, you know, I wanted to point that out. That's where the spirit really starts to, the sense of hope starts to be impacted. And think of a community. If, back to the narrative, you think of a community that feels like, oh, nothing's good here. Anything that comes out of here is bad. Or we're broken here. You know, that narrative again, that is probably the worst thing that could happen. And it's, and when it gets that far, there's a lot of work that has to be done, that's for sure.
I know you touched upon it briefly about communities suffering trauma for a long time. Can you expand a little bit about what it would take and how long it would take for a community to heal? I mean, I know you briefly mentioned about generations.
Yeah.
Can you give a little, talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I wish I were an expert at that, or that I met an expert, because I don't know if there are any yet. But I think, on the other hand, I think many of us know, like, what, you know, that first it's a big job. But think about that narrative. I guess one thing I want to say, and I think it's a whole nother topic, but if you look at poverty and racism and its effect over generations, you could certainly say that there's a case to be made that there's generational trauma and that seeps through generations. But I think from a community standpoint, and I know it interacts with what we're talking about today, from a community standpoint, that narrative, if people recognize that the narrative that we're broken, that nothing good comes out of here, I think that when I say people, I mean leadership, I mean families, churches, informal and formal leaders in the community. I guarantee you, you know, I'm talking about all these negative things, but I guarantee you there's families that are functioning in these communities. And all you need is, it's just like any other community, you know, a mom or a dad has a little extra time and, you know, starts, gets an organized team going, or tries to start a scout group and get some other people, whatever kinds of group. You know, one of the memories etched in my mind that I mentioned earlier really is the marching band, because there were parades in my grandmother's neighborhood. On most holidays, you would see a marching parade down the streets of Baltimore. I know that still happens, but if you think about the time and leadership it takes to put together something like that, you have to money for the instruments, and you have to have family support to practice the instruments, you know, and tolerant neighbors. You know, I tried to play an instrument, and I know it didn't sound too good. So, but you have to get something started, you know, and you have to have something to point to that has has pride. Now, what you're going to hear is, oh, that garden over there is just going to go to crap in a little while, and you can see the fortitude that will take leaders and families and churches and agencies, the commitment it takes to transform a neighborhood like that, and businesses. I can't think of everybody I should mention, but it takes fortitude and but it's like you have to start somewhere, and then you really have to work on sustaining things so that that narrative changes. You can't have kids being born into something's wrong here or we're not okay. That narrative is just not healthy.
Is there anything that you would like to say in regards to this topic for all of the individuals who are listening to this podcast, in summation?
I think the two things I wanted to say, I guess, are about safety and the narrative or the spirit. You know, if you're wanting to do anything that helps communities, it does matter that you do something, and it matters, especially if it affects the sense of safety that people could have or the sense of hope in a community. So if you think of that, even little things like contributing to access for families for food or access to healthcare or behavioral healthcare, you know, some counseling, somewhere to go when they see their kids or don't understand what's happening in a family. Just so important, I think, those two areas, the sense of safety, building the sense of safety and building that narrative that says, hey, there's something to live for, there's something to look forward to. We're going to be okay.
Well, I want to thank you again, Carl Fornoff, our regional director for Villa Maria Community Resources, for sharing your time, your talent, and your insights on this topic. If anyone who is listening thinks that they need help with their behavioral or mental health, please go to catholiccharities.nd.org/behavioral health and click on the link for our behavioral health services. Thanks for listening, and I hope that everyone has a great day.